marriage, Derek. It's really a pleasure and honor to be back with you all. And those were just beautifully inspiring stories. I guess Pastor Mandy has stepped out for the moment, but it was really remarkable. I found it very moving. Well, the topic of discussion for debt forgiveness from an Islamic perspective, I should first of all set up the context within which debt forgiveness occurred. What were the practices before Islam came when it comes to debt in the Arabian Peninsula? What would happen at this time was that when a debt came due, the debtor would go to the creditor, and the creditor would ask the debtor for the full amount. And if the debtor didn't have it, then they would say, all right, I'll postpone it for a year and double it. And so you can obviously see the direction that that's going. That gets to be a debt trap very, very quickly.
Sounds like a bank.
Right, but at 100% interest, you know, it's a little bit high with no inflation, you know. So these obviously got people into debt traps where they would be, in a sense, working in slavery for the rest of their lives, even if they took out a relatively small consumer loan and for whatever reason was not able to pay it back. And so a verse in the Quran, and the Quran is for Muslims the verbatim word of God. In other words, although it's revealed through the Prophet of Islam, it is God himself who is speaking. So you might think of the Quran as word-made book. Obviously in Christianity you have word-made flesh. So it's in liberation in Islam, word-made book, incarnation, word-made flesh in Christianity. So although you can make comparisons between the Quran and the Bible, really from a deeper theological point of view, it makes more sense to think of the Quran and Christ. And so the Quran states in one of its verses, or verses revealed in this context, that God and his messenger, God declares war on those who practice this form of usury, which is called riba in Arabic. Actually, that it's God declares war on them. So that's huge. I mean, that's, you can't get more harsh than that. And then the following verse states the following, and if one is in difficult circumstances, that is, the debtor is in difficult circumstances, let there be a respite until there is ease. In other words, to defer the term until the debtor is able to pay with no additional charge. And it is better for you to give it as charity. In other words, to relinquish it completely if you but knew. So it's better for us spiritually. And God promises that any act of charity that we do, even in this life, that he will reward it 70-fold and maybe more. And it's unlimited what he can give. So both in this life and the hereafter, there will be a reward for giving that, relieving that debt as charity. And a hadith, or saying of the Prophet of Islam, which is really the sayings of the Prophet, are also inspired, but they're his own words. In other words, this is not the verbatim word of God. It's not the Quran. But they're nevertheless inspired, and therefore it forms the first commentary upon the Quran. A hadith states that whosoever grants a delay to one in difficult circumstances shall be credited an act of charity for each day of it. So even if you don't forgive the loan, just by deferring until the loan, you know, deferring it with no additional charge, one is given spiritual credit for that for every day. So that deferral itself is an act of charity, even if it's just simply waiting for the debtor to have the funds to pay it back. And there's another hadith in which the Prophet of Islam states that a man would give loans to the people, and he would say to his servant, if the debtor is in hardship, you should forgive the debt, that perhaps God will relieve us. So when he met God, God relieved him. So the idea of being charitable with one another and forgiving one another of that debt, and God will forgive us. And so I want to illustrate a concrete example of this with an institution in Egypt. I'm from Egypt originally. That's called Masr al-Khair. Masr is the Arabic name for Egypt. Al-Khair means the good. And so it's a charitable organization, a major non-profit organization. I think it's maybe the largest NGO in Egypt. That one of its functions is to provide debt relief for those who have gotten trapped into debt. Because in southern Egypt, in the south of Egypt, when a daughter gets married, for example, the mother or the father want to provide their daughter a gift, whether it's a washing machine or something like that. Something very basic. But many of these people, unfortunately, are unlettered. So instead of, you basically have these loan sharks who are out there who don't write down the terms of the business contract. So there's no evidence of what the terms were. But they have the person put their thumbprint on the equivalent of an informal check. In Egypt, you have a system where you have, of course, the formal banking system where you have checks and all of these kinds of things, but there's also an informal system which is legally enforceable, in which an unlettered person, without having a bank account, can do the equivalent of a check without the bank, and it's considered by law as a contract, as good as a check. And because there's no written contract, the creditor can charge these outrageous interest rates. And there's no evidence of the terms of the actual contract. And so it creates a debt trap for the debtor. And the creditor is squeezing the debtor like crazy. And then they go to the court, and the judge sees this basically check that appears to be no good, and there's no evidence that the person has, you know, what the terms of the original deal was. And so the judge, unfortunately, is forced to sentence that debtor to go to jail. Because in Egypt, there's no such thing as a bankruptcy law that you can just, you know, kind of get off with the debt and that's it. Because unfortunately, sometimes that's been abused in the other direction by people who are, you know, really could have paid the debt and they, you know, try to get out with it. So getting back to Pastor Mandy's example that, you know, the need to make it sustainable. So anyway, to make a long story short, what Masr al-Khair has done is that they have relieved thousands and thousands of people. They've gotten tens of thousands of people out of jail. And you know what the average debt is, tragically? Less than $1,000. But to just get them out of jail, to go through the mechanics of the legal system, you know, they had to coordinate this with the parliament and the former Grand Mufti of Egypt, the chief legal judge in Egypt was involved in this, and all these business people. It was a major effort. They had to get legislation to kind of smooth this process. Now, after somebody gets out of jail, what Masr al-Khair does is that they help get them employed and back to work, because there's a stigma, obviously, associated with having gone to jail. So what are you going to do next? So Masr al-Khair sticks with the debtors all the way. They provide a job for them. They first of all assess where their talents are, where their strengths are, help provide training for them to succeed in that, and they don't let their hands go. And that's the key to the success of Masr al-Khair. They keep with it, and they provide whatever training is necessary and constant follow-up. And so that's just one example of how these Islamic principles of basically other people donating charity to pay off these debts, and quite frankly, trying to educate people on how not to get into these kinds of traps to begin with. That's really the long-term solution to eliminate these things right in the butt. And so Islam also encourages making loans. So to get back to Pastor Mandy's story, to make things sustainable, since Islam encourages making loans, there's a hadith of the Prophet to the effect that if somebody comes to you and you know of their need and they've expressed that to you, and if you're able to help and you don't help, that really is a sin of omission, so to speak. So that person then, if they are able to pay the debt, is really in an obligation, you know, they really have a deep moral obligation to pay that back, because it's being spiritually encouraged for people to make the loans to begin with, so that if those loans are repaid, then that can continue. It can be a virtuous circle, to, you know, relate that back to the sustainability question of making the blessings sustainable. And so there's very heavy sanction in the, according to the hadith, of not paying one's debt back if one can. It's extremely serious crime. It's not just a sin against the individual. It's a sin against the whole of the community. And so there's a hadith that says a Muslim, or just the principle, that a Muslim who delays paying in spite of being capable of doing so has really committed oppression upon all Muslims, in a sense, or the entire community. Whatever, whether it's Muslim, Jewish, Christian, any, the whole of the community. And so, so much for the question of debt relief from the Sinai point of view. How many more minutes do I have?
You have an hour and a half.
Oh, all right. I thought I only had 20 minutes. Sorry. I'm not sure I should have put a stopwatch on this. But in any case, and so that's just a kind of quick overview of the Islamic view of debt relief. So it's a balance. On the one hand, yes, forgive the debt, but on the other hand, if the debtor can pay, they should. Now, when it comes to welcoming the stranger, this in Arabic is called Ibn Sabil. It's like the wayfarer. And of course, the Prophet of Islam himself was orphaned at a very young age, and in a sense was in a place of need. And there's a whole verse of, or surah, or chapter of the Quran that's devoted to this biography, or has biographical elements of the Prophet, where God says to him, "Didn't we not find you an orphan and raised you? Yeah, did we not find you in need and we provided for you?" And so forth and so on. So because some members, when there was a break in the revelation, some members of the Quraysh, they said, "Oh, God has abandoned you," and so forth and so on. So this verse was revealed, in a sense, to come from the heart of the Prophet. And so he himself came from a very difficult background. Although he was born into the most noble tribe of of Saudi Arabia, of Mecca at the time. It was the most noble tribe and the head of the clan of the tribe. He himself, because he lost his parents at a very young age, was in a very socioeconomic challenged position, so to speak. And so this Ibn Sabil, or the wayfarer, who is going through a hardship and challenging, is also brought out very clearly in the Quran. In one verse it states, "Righteousness is not that you turn your faces to the east or west," because depending on which side of Mecca you're on, that's the direction of prayer, Mecca, and that turning our faces east or west, or when we conclude the prayer, we say salams, or peace, to those on our right and those on our left. But true righteousness is in one who believes in God, the last day, the angels, the books, and the prophets, and gives wealth, in spite of love of it, to relatives, orphans, the needy, the traveler, Ibn Sabil. And that traveler can be anyone who, for example, is moving from one city to another. So let's say somebody's making a transition from one city to another and is not able to find work. It's the obligation of the Muslim community to provide for that person until they can find work. Regardless of religion, this applies to any, whether Muslim, Jewish, Christian, whatever tradition they hail from, the Muslim community is required to support that out of the funds of zakat, or the mandatory tithes. And so in the following verse, The wayfarer is also entitled, anyway, there are several verses that refer to the wayfarer being entitled to shares of revenue streams that are associated with the Islamic State, whether it's in taxes, whether it's in various other revenues that come. So they have a share in it. And the Prophet said that the one who denies a wayfarer, for example, somebody who's traveling, his surplus water is one of three persons as whom God will not look at on the Day of Judgment. And so these are just quick examples of the wayfarer. And how that manifested itself in Islamic history is that when oppression was so great in Mecca upon the Muslims, because the Meccans were idol worshippers, and it was, you might say, they were making a lot of money off of, you know, every tribe having its own god. And so the Prophet, you can imagine, saying, no, there's just one God and you should drop all these idols. That's not good for the family business, so to speak. It would be like somebody, you know, coming from a family on Wall Street saying, no, all that speculation is, you know, should be forbidden or something like that. Imagine what that could do to the family fortune. So this was very bad for business. And so they started to oppress the Prophet and the Muslim community. I mean, they would torture people and, you know, of course they couldn't get to the Prophet himself because he was had protection from other members of the family, but it got very bad for some people. But they would harass him and when he was in prayer, do all kinds of terrible things, throw, you know, I don't even want to get into that, but in any case, it was a very oppressive environment. So then the Prophet was ordered to take the community to migrate to Medina. And he would be the last one to make the migration. And this is called the Hijra, the migration. And during this migration, when they arrived in the city of Medina, traveling from Mecca, the community in Medina were renamed by the Prophet the Ansar, the helpers. And so the helpers would welcome those who had made the migration by sharing with them half their wealth. They just gave half of their... Well, so talk about welcoming the stranger. I mean, that's it's a really very beautiful thing. And so this is an example. These are just a couple of examples of the stranger. Now, the final point that I guess I'll just close with is how are these kinds of spiritual values sustainable in our current environment? It's very difficult because on the one hand, we have all of these spiritual values and ethical principles that we would like to live up to. But we live in an environment in which we have a lot of degrading markets and work is often degrading in itself with a mechanistic worldview that we live in that does violence to both man and nature. And by man, I mean the human state, of course. And so in an environment that is driven by this mechanistic worldview that generates these scientific, technological, economic, political, and other social structures that do this type of violence to man and nature, it's very easy for us to become jaded. And so work is not something that just is transitive, that we make objects out there. It also affects our character. It's intransitive. The work stays with us and within us. And so over time, if we don't change the paradigm within which we educate our children from a mechanistic paradigm to a holistic paradigm, and our production and exchange processes from a mechanistic to a holistic approach, then all of these other values that we're talking about are really not going to be sustainable. It's trying to, you know, in a sense, change the course of the railroad track after it's left the station. I mean, it's structurally on a certain track, and we individually don't have much control over that. All we can do is try to jump off the train ourselves. So, anyway, that's why I believe that it's essential that for these values to be sustainable, we also need a massive shift in our educational paradigm. and our worldview as well.